Chris Kershaw tipping pitches. CJ, how does the hitter see that and take advantage?
Well, first and foremost, Chris, if it did happen, it always happens when the pitcher is in the stretch. Rarely can you pick up pitches when a guy is thrown from the windup, and that's what we saw in that seventh inning.
How you feeling over there?
I'm a little sick.
Yeah.
But I'm pushing through it because God forbid anyone ever miss a single core class. You might fail. No joke, my professor a few weeks ago said that kids shouldn't get up to go to the bathroom during lecture. I was like,
oh, that's actually, NYU is an elementary school. I don't know if you knew that.
I'm just going to start raising my hand. Just going to call him and be like, can I go to the bathroom?
Yo, there would be kids who like did that freshman year who like raised their hand, and professors would be like, you don't have to, you're an adult, you can leave.
Yeah,
like, just
people
go.
Do that in my recitation. I'm like, yo, it's not that serious.
Yeah, seriously.
It's like, you are an adult. Anyway.
I love how we start out our podcast now just like talking about like
NYU.
Our school.
Yeah. So we're back early from our last podcast, only been a couple of days, but we had the opportunity to interview Anthony DiComo, the Mets beat reporter for MLB.com, which he is our first guest, and that's really exciting. So that's coming up later in the show.
Yeah, insert air horn sound here.
You know I'm actually going to insert an air horn sound.
So that's good. We had a nice chat with him.
Yeah, it was really fun. So shout out to him for just agreeing to talk to two college kids for their college radio podcast. But in all seriousness, it's a really exciting time to be a baseball fan.
So exciting. It's October, baby.
Yeah, exactly. It's officially October, and hashtag October baseball is coming.
Oh, yeah.
We're coming to you on a Tuesday, and the AL wildcard game is tonight. So forgive us for not having any hot takes about what happens in that. Although my hot take prediction is going to be Yankees 10-2. That's mine.
10-2. Wow. I don't even know who's starting for the Twins tonight.
Irvin Santana.
Santana, okay.
He's 16-8 this year. That just goes to show you wins mean nothing.
we're recording this without the benefit of foresight and like anything. We're going to talk about the playoffs for a few minutes, and it will probably end up being outdated because we're going to be like, oh, I can't wait to see all these Twins players. And then the Twins aren't even going to be there. But you know,
I'm not that excited for any Twins players, so you're going to be outdated.
Wow. Man.
I am sad. Miguel Sano, it was reported earlier today, is going to miss the wild card game.
Yeah.
That's a shame because I went to a Twins-Yankees game 2 years ago, and Miguel Sano hit one like 470. It went straight over the bleachers. It was like duck for cover type of home run.
He's not human.
Nope. The playoffs are starting, and
I start to get like a little tingling feeling in my stomach. I get excited, man. This is what it all comes down to.
So this was kind of a weird season because we had the first half. We like our very first podcast. We were talking about two historically dominant teams in the Astros and the Dodgers, and now everyone has completely forgot about both of those teams for the most part, and everyone is just focused on the Indians and their quest to end their 68-year drought. But this kind of gets to a larger sense of what is really interesting to people going into this postseason. So are there things that you're specifically excited for watching? I mean, obviously, the tingle in your stomach for October baseball comes no matter what October it is.
Yeah.
But this is, I think, a particularly compelling one because there were a lot of ridiculously hot teams earlier in the season, and a couple of them cooled off a little bit. But that talent that's on their roster that we were ranting and raving about in every single episode for the first like six of this podcast was just like, we couldn't go 5 minutes without mentioning the Dodgers. Like, they are still the Dodgers. They still have all those really good players on their team. So for you, what are you looking forward to most now that October is all starting?
I didn't really write anything down, so I'm just kind of going off the top of my head. So I'm probably going to forget some major things going down. Definitely tonight, watching Aaron Judge just in the playoffs. This is our first Judge-filled playoffs, and hopefully we see much more of him than just a few hours tonight because I want to watch him just hit decisive home runs for the next month, and they go like 500 feet. So that's going to be fun. And on the other side of the diamond, the Twins have a ton of really fun players, so I think the Yankees are probably going to win. I am probably, Mom, cover your ears, I'm probably rooting for the Twins, because I just think they are a really compelling, young, fun team. I really want to see Bartolo Colon in the playoffs. And
is he even going to get in, though?
I don't know. I feel like you just have to do it just like for just posterity's sake. Like,
you just want to see the camera come to him every once in a while.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Oh, he's not going to be in the rotation. I don't think he's going to pitch an inning, but I want him to be there. His aura, you know?
Okay. Picture this. Tonight, it's like a 5-5 tie. The game goes like 26 innings. Bartolo Colon has to come in and pitch like five.
Oh, real quick, on the Aaron Judge thing, I just want to point out, with the season wrapped up, he has joined some very elite company because he is only the second player, I believe only the second player in Major League history to have a 30% strikeout rate and still hit 280, which is wild to me. Just, I mean, the dude strikes out like no other. I mean, he has, you know, one of the highest strikeout rates in baseball, and that he hits the ball so damn hard. I just don't get, this is an aside that has nothing to do with what we're doing, but the only other person to do that is Jose Hernandez in 2002 with the Brewers. And the only reason he managed to do that was because he had a 400 BABIP, which is like the 12th highest of all time or something like that.
What year was it?
2002.
Oh, I was going to say, was that from like a very early on season, and that the reason that his BABIP was so high was because people couldn't move and field the ball.
I'm just kind of boggled about how this happened at all. His strikeout rate was 32% that year.
Yikes.
And yet he still almost hit 290.
So Judge finished with 8.2 Fangraphs WAR. They were talking about this on Effectively Wild today.
Yeah.
And that is, I think, fourth highest for rookies all time behind like Trout, Shoeless Joe. I don't remember who the number three was, but just to be in that company and to have a stretch of the season where all he did for like a month straight was just strike out is wild. But anyway, enough ranting about Aaron Judge. We figured we might as well get it in.
We're excited to see him. In case you weren't aware.
I mean, we might as well get it in now because like in the chance that they get eliminated, no one wants to listen to us just rave about Aaron Judge while his team's not even in the playoffs anymore. But yeah, so I think what I'm looking forward to a lot is I hate to enter into the echo chamber, but I'm really excited to see the Indians at full strength this year. They had a lot of weird things go wrong for them last year in terms of injuries, and Trevor Bauer got assaulted by a drone. And like one of the underrated things from...
Did you know, I think that happened again this year. Like I saw a story a couple weeks ago that like he was playing with the drone again and got hurt by it.
What?
It's like a yearly thing.
How did we not talk about this?
Nope, that's wrong.
Fake news on the podcast?
Fake news on the podcast, but he did lose it. So every year, we're going to have some sort of Trevor Bauer drone story.
I'm worried for what's next. The drone attacks someone else from the other team. Just like progressively anarchy. But no, so they had a lot of weird things go wrong last year, and they lost like some top of the rotation starters that they have this year. So one of the underrated things from 2016 was just, I mean, underrated among like the casual fan because everyone was just gushing over the Cubs and the curse and all that stuff. But was the way that Terry Francona chose to use Andrew Miller. And he doesn't have to do that this year, right? So he can use him in sort of like a... He can pick his spots a little better with him, and hopefully Andrew Miller still has an arm by the end of the postseason, whereas like last year, he was pretty burned out. So I'm really excited to see just how he chooses to use Miller and that strong bullpen in general, because he doesn't have to. The way his hand is not forced. So let's see if what he was doing was because he thought it was the best option or just because it was his only option last year. I'm excited to see those mind games. And I've talked about Terry Francona on this podcast a few times, but just I admire him as a manager, and I think he seems like a really cool dude. So hopefully they don't get bounced in the first round by like the Twins or the Yankees.
Yo, we're gonna see some madness this year. I'm kind of excited. We got some fun team. I mean, I'm still pulling for my Rockies, obviously. I think what was my take that they're making it to the NLCS this year?
Yes.
Yeah.
No, the World Series.
Oh, they have to win the NLCS?
Yep.
Fuck. All right, so they have to beat the Dodgers and then either the Nationals or the Cubs. Oh, okay. But first they have to get through the Diamondbacks. This is a piece of cake. I don't know what anyone's talking about.
It's in the bag. The other thing I'm worried but also excited about, because I hate love the Nationals, because like a baseball team that is this good and this loaded with talent and that is performing in the way that they did this year, they won 97 games this year. Like, let's be real. That's ridiculous. But is obviously a rival of the Mets and has so many players that I dislike. I feel like I need to continue my trend of just picking them to win the World Series every year, because that way I reverse jinx them. So right here, right now, Nats, World Series champions 2017. How do you feel?
That's a take, certainly. I don't know if I agree with it, but...
Not the point.
I could see it. I mean, the thing is, like, these next few weeks are just essentially a toss-up. Like, any one of these teams could win. You could tell me, like, right now, like, for certainty that XYZ team is going to win, and I'd be like, yeah, that makes sense. We do have some of the historically best teams ever. And it's very weird because, like, we talked about the Astros for, like, the first few weeks of the season and, like, the Nationals here and there. But these are, like, two teams who have just quietly been great, like, amazing the entire year, but have just happened to be overshadowed by the historically good Dodgers and the historically bad Dodgers and the Indians who just may... Have they lost in the last few years? I don't really remember. So I can't remember the last time they lost.
In dramatic fashion?
Yeah.
Anyway, at the risk of bantering far too long before our interview with...
There's no such thing.
before our interview with Anthony DeComo, just to wrap things up, both of our teams, as you might know, are eliminated from the playoffs.
What? The A's and Mets aren't in the playoffs?
Why are we even watching?
What?
Yes, so both of our teams are eliminated from the playoffs, and they have been for a long time. They had two of the worst records in the league. But that being said, they've traded away a lot of good players in the last few years, so there are many former Mets and former A's who are in contention for a World Series ring this year. So just to kind of put a bow on our fandom this season and switch over to our appreciation for other teams,
Yeah. We
are going to list and talk about those foreign players and who we want to see get a ring the most. So for me, as a Mets fan, it's got to be Curtis Granderson, just because, I mean, we talked at length when he got traded, but just the ultimate good guy and someone I want to see come back as the Mets manager.
Oh, my God. Not to play into our trope, but I love him. I love him so much. He's just fun to watch. And he is a genuinely good guy. And I think of every player in the playoffs this year, I think you could argue that he deserves it more than anyone else, pretty much.
And rounding out this list for me, a guy that I kind of forgot about because he's very old and it's been a long time since he made a big impact on the team that I was watching regularly, but that's Carlos Beltran. People forget how ridiculously good he was for the Mets. And he will go into the Hall of Fame, I assume, at some point. And he will probably go in with no hat. But I think his peak was for the Mets team that made it to the NLCS and lost in tragic fashion. So I feel like he almost got robbed of one that year. And we as a fan base got robbed of one that year, which I don't want to talk about anymore. But I would like to see him. I like to see the older guy get a ring. And I think he's been really graceful about the way that he's aged and about the skills that he's lost. Like when the Astros had the... funeral for his glove because he's only DHing. Amazing. And he will never see the field again. Yeah. I think that's really funny. So I think it would be cool to see him get a ring, and that Astros team is fun.
He's one of the best switch hitters of all time, which I feel like I forget sometimes that he's a switch hitter, but I think that you put him up there of guys who hit from both sides of the plate. He was one of the best to do it in terms of like all around skills. And especially like you mentioned skills that has dropped off, and you mentioned skills that have dropped off in the last few years, and he hasn't really run much as of late. But like, I think the last time I checked, he has like 300 career stolen bases. He's like a 300 player, which especially for a switch hitter is, I think, pretty rare. So
yeah, he was ridiculous at his peak. One of the more underrated, I think, just because he's aged out of it for so long. But anyway, one of my fatal flaws as a baseball fan / analyzer / someone who claims to be tuned into the game is that I forget who's a switch hitter all the time. And so when someone comes up and is hitting from the opposite side of what my brain thinks they should be hitting, I'm like, what the hell is he doing?
Yeah.
Someone who I forgot for a long time was Asdrubal Cabrera, just because the Mets signed him. But he didn't like come up through the Mets farm system, and he wasn't someone who was on my radar before he was on the Mets, really, because he was in the other league, and you know, it's not like he was Mike Trout. So he came to the Mets, and for like at least a season, every single time he came up and hit on the right side, I was like, "What is this guy doing?" onto the next Met that I would like, the next former Met, sad, that I would like to see get a World Series ring. I'm going to go with Jay Bruce here. I didn't feel great about putting him in the third slot, but when I thought more about it, I enjoyed my time with Jay Bruce as a Mets fan, and I wasn't a crazy big fan.
Did you?
Yeah.
I just feel like it was pretty love-hate at times. You you had some rants to me about why Jay Bruce is still a Met, and I hope he's not a Met the following season, and why is he still playing in the field, and why?
Listen, the AL suits him.
Yeah, it does.
He's still playing out in the field, right? He's not just DHing for that team, but he's been on a tear since he went over to the Indians.
It's been incredible.
Yeah, and maybe it's that lost lover mentality that once they're gone, you appreciate everything they did well, but I think this generally comes from the fact that I would like to see the baseball team from Cleveland go on to get a ring, and I think that would be like the storybook ending that everyone deserves. Well, that never really happens in baseball. And then rounding out, I have six here just because there were two guys at the end that I couldn't leave off. Four, I feel kind of lukewarm about. It's Justin Turner. Kind of still wish he was on the Mets. He's really good. Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't mind seeing the Dodgers win. So by proxy, I wouldn't mind seeing Justin Turner win. He seems like he should be on Game of Thrones, and that's a fun thing that I think. And then dead last, not necessarily fifth and sixth. If there are some Mets that I forgot in the middle there, that's fine. But dead last have to be Murphy and Oliver Perez.
No Clippard mention, huh? I'm pulling for him, I think.
I don't see he's the one of the few that checks both boxes. He is a former A and a former Met.
I don't feel very strongly about him.
Do you remember when the Mets traded for Tyler Clippard and I texted you and I said, "Yeah, I just stole your bullpen," and you were like, "Yeah."
I was like, "Bye."
You were literally like kicking him out the door. But anyway, you know, I have a complicated fandom relationship with Daniel Murphy because he dragged the Mets to the 2015 World Series. But I just don't want to see the Nationals win because then...
And yet they are your pick.
I don't want to see the Nationals win just because then the Mets, every single time the Mets play the Nationals next year, it'll be like the Mets matching up with the reigning World Series champions, and I'll just roll my eyes every single time and it'll be really depressing. But yeah, that rounds it out. And obviously Oliver Perez... I don't even need to say why I don't want him to win a World Series. I'm pretty sure the Mets are still giving him checks. Anyway, so how about you, the A's former players? They are abundant, huh?
So I'm just going to, and I'll hone in on some guys who I'm pulling for. But real quick, the good people over at Athletics Nation compile the list of the former A's who will be competing in this year's playoffs.
You have to think about it. There are 10 baseball teams who made the playoffs.
There are.
So what you probably figure there's like 4, 5, maybe 6 or 7 former A's who are in the playoffs and, you know, bounced around to other teams over time, right?
There's about enough to make up a 25-man roster of their own. I'm just gonna go down this list for you real quick. Sonny Gray, Matt Holliday, Bartolo Colon, Adam Rosales, Pat Neshek, Carlos Gonzalez, Luke Gregerson, Tyler Clippard, Josh Reddick, Brad Peacock, Max Stassi, Dan Otero, Craig Breslow, Edwin Encarnacion, Drew Pomeranz, Fernando Abad, Rajay Davis, love, Chris Young, Rich Hill, Brandon McCarthy, Andre Ethier, John Lester, Ben Zobrist, Addison Russell, Stephen Drew, Joe Blanton, AJ Cole, Sean Doolittle, Gio Gonzalez, Ryan Madsen.
Wow. Catch your breath. Good Lord. And that is a good-ass team if you put them all on the same team.
You know, like, as an A's fan, you make jokes all the time. It's like, oh, what if you could, like, make a team out of all the guys who you, like, traded away? Or, like, oh, we trade away so much talent. But holy crap, we traded away so much talent. I know that this is like, over the last decade or so. Like, Joe Blanton has not been an A in years.
He hasn't been good in years either. Every single time he comes out of the bullpen for the Nationals, I'm like, damn, Joe Blanton's on the Nationals. He's on the team.
And like has been good in the last few years. I mean, he was good for good for the Dodgers.
He stuck that graceful landing into the bullpen.
Yeah, I mean, he really retooled his career. I'm excited to see Sonny Gray. I'm really sad it's not going to be in an A's uniform, but if you see him. True. I'll be excited to watch him tonight. Or I guess not watch him tonight. Well, anyway, I'm pulling to see, but I want the Twins to win, so I don't even know. I'm glad he's there.
Look at the conflicts in this studio right now. We're getting pulled in multiple directions. The biggest names that pop out to you, though, real quick, because we got to get to that Tecomo interview.
Bartolo.
True.
Again, hoping he gets there.
Although he's won a World Series before, though.
Yeah.
Does he need another? He won one and like...
No, but if we're just talking guys who I'm excited to watch this postseason, fingers crossed, hopefully, that'll be fun. Oh, Josh Reddick.
True.
I am so excited to watch him in the playoffs. His flowing, greasy, gross hair.
Oh, so greasy. Well, now that he's not getting base hits and doubles against your team, you can actually finally root for him again. Like, every time we were watching an A's-Astros game this year, every time he did anything good, it would just rip your heart straight out of your chest. And I was like, damn, I really feel bad sitting next to you watching this happen. Like, I'm just watching you crumble. But now that the A's are not there, you can finally root for him with a good conscience.
I'm pulling for Rajay Davis to pull some more postseason magic. I know he did his thing last year, but I just love him as a player, and I love him as a person, and the grit that he plays with, goes out there, leaves it all on the field. Love him. It's a little weird watching him in a Red Sox uniform. I don't associate him with the Red Sox at all, but that'll be good. And then Sean Doolittle, who I...
just got married.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, congratulations.
So...
in the time that the Nationals, like, clinched the division, don't have to play in the wild card, Sean Doolittle was like, I'll elope.
Yeah, seriously. His wife,
baseball players are wild.
His wife, like, tweeted out pictures and was like, we just had a day off, so, like, we just went and did this. And everyone's like, oh, all right.
Love it.
Anyway, they look hella happy together.
Yeah, congratulations to them. But love is real.
They'll definitely be hella happier if they get a second ring this fall. So pulling for them on that one. Lots of good guys. Lots of good guys on former A's, former Mets. So that's fun. It's going to be a fun postseason.
We have plenty of teams that we could find a reason to be happy if they won. So even though our seasons were filled with disappointment, it'll be a little better.
Yo, this is... I'm juiced. I'm getting excited now. Now that we're talking about it, the blood's flowing.
All right, that'll do it for our pre-postseason analysis.
Yeah.
But without further ado, we're going to get to that interview with Anthony DeComo. So when we come back, Anthony DeComo, Mets beat writer for MLB.com. All right, just one quick note before we get to the DeComo interview. There was a little bit of an issue with the audio at times on the call, just some static on his phone call and perhaps some wind, but please, if you can forgive that, it was a good interview, so enjoy, and yeah. Today, we are really excited to welcome our first guest of the podcast, and that is Mets beat reporter for MLB.com, Anthony DeComo. Anthony, how's it going?
Good, how are you?
Good, good. So I feel like we have to start with the absolute mayhem that was this Mets season. As a beat writer, what is that like for you, just in terms of how do you follow along and deal with this fatalistic fan base on a day-to-day basis? How are you sleeping at all right now?
Yeah. You know, honestly, it doesn't – the record of the team or how the team does doesn't really – affect my day-to-day as someone who follows the team. There's always something going on. There's always something to report on, to write on, regardless of whether they're a first place team or a last place team. I think the Mets in particular are a great example of that type of thing, because the fan base is so invested and so interested in that. You know, while it wanes a little bit when the team's not as good, you lose maybe some of the more casual fans, the fans that come out when they're going to the postseason and all that. There's such a big, solid core of fans that are in on every pitch, regardless of how the team is, and in many ways are more vocal when the team is bad. So there's still a ton of interest in all the goings-on. There's still a ton of interest in what happens this year, what happens next year, what the team does going forward, and that much just really doesn't change.
I feel like we have to talk about the elephant in the room here, the news that broke in the last few days, and that's the fact that Jacob deGrom finally cut his hair. what do you think this means for the team going forward?
I think people forget that Jacob deGrom actually had a close-cropped haircut for his entire life as a prospect, really, until he got to the big leagues, and then he started to grow it out. He had been toying with this for a couple of years and couldn't quite pull the trigger, but I guess that finally changed.
So yeah, I remember last season they were saying he was saying that he wanted to cut his hair after the season, and essentially Mets fans like talked him off the ledge about it.
Yeah, fans. I wonder if his agent didn't have something to do with that. There are some shampoo endorsements I believe he's had in the past. I'm not even joking. But yeah, I guess he got to a point where it was just too much to maintain.
Hey, whatever works, right?
I just want to say I'm for it. I think it looks good. It's a fresh start, you could say.
In all seriousness, as you know, as Bobby alluded to, and as every Mets fan knows, and I'm sure the team knew as well, right? It's a very topsy-turvy season. And especially when you have something like this, I think a lot of people start talking about the chemistry of the team and how the manager plays into that, right? When a team is doing really well, everyone's like, oh, well, the chemistry is really great. And when the team is doing not so hot, it's like, oh, there's a lot of tension in the clubhouse. And so given how much, I think, bad luck fell upon the Mets this season, I'm kind of curious your perspective of things, kind of being in there with the team, among the players, with the coaches. How did they, was that chemistry, did it get to be a little tense at all? I mean, and how did Terry Collins kind of play into that over the course of the season and respond to that?
Well, chemistry is a hard thing to pin down and a hard thing to define. And I think by and large, any team that wins, people are going to say they have good chemistry because they're winning. Are they winning because they have good chemistry? I think no, in large part, it's the opposite. They have good chemistry because they're winning. But how do you define that? Did the 1986 Mets have good chemistry? They were as dysfunctional a group as you'll ever see in your entire life. But they won, so people said it's all fun. If they weren't winning, everyone would have a totally different perspective on what went on with that group. So I think it's a tricky concept. I think with this year's team, it's a little interesting because they were never really in it. They were essentially out of the races in May and June, and by midsummer, by late July, by August, when they started trading pieces off, really, almost everyone with any bit of big league experience was gone. The leaders, the so-called leaders, weren't around the clubhouse on a day-to-day basis. You had really just Jose Reyes and Asdrubal Cabrera, and then some of the younger pitchers who were getting a little older, like Jacob deGrom, for instance. As guys who were kind of in there and had been there and seen that and done that. But by that point, the season was so far gone that I'm not sure there was a tension, there was anything like that. I think it was just a team that knew this wasn't its year and was playing out the string and various guys playing for different things. But no, I never really got a negative vibe from the clubhouse this year. And I think a lot of it had to do from that a lot of the older guys were gone. And in September, the clubhouse was filled with 23-year-olds who were just trying to make good impressions going forward. So it was loose towards the end. These guys knew what their situation was. It wasn't like a tight team that was coming out and had big expectations of winning and fell flat at the end. I mean, they had their expectations, but by the time we got to this point, those were far gone.
Right, and it is very interesting that point you bring up about the young guys coming up, right? Because at a certain point, it takes a lot of the pressure off. If you know that you're out of the race already, right, you can kind of play every day knowing that maybe your job isn't totally in danger because you're in the playoff hunt, right? Or you can afford to have a little wiggle room and bring up some guys who maybe wouldn't have otherwise gotten the chance to make that impression in August, September, the dog's days of baseball, just because you can afford to do that, because whether you win or lose is not really the goal at that point. So I think that's interesting.
Yeah, and then I kind of wanted to pivot a little bit to the other widely discussed thing this year, and that was obviously injuries. The Mets pin a lot of their team success on the health of their starting pitching, as has been much talked about, much written about. I've always been kind of curious, was this an organizational rebuilding directive to build around the pitching, or is this kind of something that these young, hard-throwing pitchers just kind of fell into their lap and they chose to take that opportunity, or did they always want to build around pitching from the top down?
No, I think to the contrary. I think given his druthers, Sandy Alderson would have preferred to built around hitting, but he inherited this organization in late 2010, and this is what he had. There was essentially nothing in the minor leagues hitting-wise of any great value. of great potential. He inherited Matt Harvey, who was their top pitching prospect at the time. He inherited Jacob DeGrom, who kind of came up and became that guy. And then, you know, you look at the trades he made. They actually wanted a hitter for Carlos Beltran, the first big trade that the Mets made, and they wound up with a pitcher instead in Zach Wheeler, because that was the best deal that came across their table. So add one more to the list. Noah Syndergaard wound up, you know, he was not the number one guy in the deal for R.A. Dickey that the Mets made a couple of years later. Travis d'Arnaud was another hitter, but Syndergaard panned out to a much better extent for the Mets. So I think it was a matter of circumstances. In some of it, it was a matter of luck that they built this stable of young pitching. But I think, as I said, given his druthers, it would have been the other way around, because Sandy Alderson understands as much as anyone how difficult it is to build around pitching. The attrition rate is just so much greater. The injuries are so much greater. It's so much harder to predict, even guys who don't get hurt, what they will do at the next level, what they will do at the big league level. So it's a difficult thing. I think you've seen in recent drafts, the Mets have really tried to hone in on hitters. Michael Conforto was the first one that they really hit on big time, and that's kind of evened out. Now you look at the system, and you've got a couple of big hitters that came up this year in Ahmed Rosario and Dominic Smith, and there's really not a lot on the horizon pitching-wise, and I think that speaks to what the Mets have made a priority in recent years.
Do you have a sense of kind of, I mean, it's clear that coming out of this season, they're doing some reorganization, they're clearing house a little bit, so to speak, right, with moving Collins around and getting rid of Worthen as well. Do you have a sense of whether, of what direction they're trying to go in terms of if they're just going to cross their fingers, you know, reset for next year, hope that the pitchers come back healthy? Are they going to try and retool some things? And because I know, I mean, I'm an A's fan, and I know how frustrating it can be to watch your front office not always commit to some sort of strategy, right? And just always try and compete every year that and then always end up like in the middle of the pack, right? So do you have a sense of what the goals are for 2018 and kind of beyond that?
Yeah, this front office still very much views this as a playoff team, as a team that can compete for a title. And how realistic that is, I think, is going to depend on large part what they do this winter. Unlike last year, when they didn't really have a ton of holes, but they did have they didn't really have a ton of obvious places where they could improve the roster last year. They re-signed Yoenis Cespedes, and that was about it. They brought back the same team. Well, this year, they've got a ton of holes. They've got holes in the infield. They've got a hole in the outfield. They've got really a hole in the rotation that they'd like to fill up with someone durable. They could always use more relief help. So they have to go out, and they have a lot of things that they need to get done this winter via free agency, via trades. And the idea is that they will do that. They will get some veterans, and they will get back to being what they thought they would be this season, which is a team built around starting pitching that is also capable of hitting enough to be a contender. And I think, you know, if you take a step back and look at this club, first got really good in 2015. They were probably a little ahead of schedule at that point, certainly making the World Series. I don't think anyone really saw that going into the year. In 2016, they were expected to compete. They did make the wild card game, and this year they were expected to compete. And realistically, you look at these windows for teams like the Mets, they tend to be in that 4 or 5 year range. And you look at the pitching, which is now actually pretty expensive, with Matt Harvey in his final year of arbitration, Juris Familia is in arbitration. A lot of these younger guys are, you know, you wonder how long is this window, just one more season. And if it is, I think, you know, the Mets might have to go about things differently next season if they don't compete. If they do the same thing they did this year and guys get hurt and they stumble and they're out of contention by midseason, at that point, do they look at trading a Jacob DeGrom, for example, and really committing to a full rebuild? Because they haven't done that. They sold off some veterans this year to save money, to shore up their farm system, only to a very small extent, in that they acquired a bunch of relief pitchers that could be useful in the short term. Do they more commit to a rebuild if it doesn't pan out this year? I think it's something they're going to have to look at. But as for right now, they're not even thinking that way. They see this as a competitive team that wants to make the playoffs.
Yeah, and I think the big thing with that window closing is that that makes this next managerial decision so important. And I know it's obviously, of course, too early for us to kind of guess what those specific names might be, because the season just ended a couple of days ago. But do you have any sense of what kind of face they're looking to bring in? I mean, they've had one of the older managers, if not the oldest manager in the MLB for the last few years with Terry Collins. Do you get the sense that they want to change that and freshen it up in this last year of that window that you talked about? Or where do you think they're, as an organization, their head is at for what kind of manager can capitalize on this closing window?
Yeah, I think you've got two things at play here. One is that you're looking at a team that, like I said, is not looking to rebuild. They're looking to win in 2018. And two, you're looking at that X factor, which is you play in New York. You have the biggest media market in the country that's coming out. And I think in this day and age, a huge part of the manager's job is media management. I think it's something that Terry Collins was very good at. He was good at kind of dictating the storylines and what the club wanted to say on a day-to-day basis. And I think that's something that comes really with experience. I don't think it's something that many people are naturals at. So I think for that reason alone, I'm really interested in signing a manager that has done it before. Not to say someone like Alex Cora, for example, who's getting a lot of early on, can't do the job and do it at a high level, but I'm not sure that that's going to be risk. I've done it to someone who hasn't done it. Because first-year managers can be tight with the media. They don't really know what to expect. They haven't really had to deal with it on a day-to-day basis in their lives before. So I think experience is a huge factor. Then you look at some people who might not have experience, like Cora is one, but one that really kind of catches my eye is Kevin Long. And while he does not have that experience, he was the hitting coach here for the past two seasons, and he's very comfortable with the players. The players in the clubhouse like him a lot. He's comfortable with the media, having been a hitting coach in New York and a pretty public one and a pretty available one for most of the last decade. So I think he checks a lot of boxes that the Mets would want, despite not having that managerial experience. So there's any number of directions they can go. It sounds like they're going to cast a really, really wide net and interview a lot of people. And this is going to be a process that takes the better part of a month, if not more than that. So I do think, though, when you look at this job in particular and you look at how the manager's job has evolved over the last 15, 20 years in baseball, these are no longer the most important decision makers in the organization. Most of that goes to the front office these days. These are instead kind of the day-to-day face of your franchise. It's the guy you put out there to answer questions. It's the guy who takes a lot of heat when things go wrong. And I think you need someone who can stand up there and has at least to a certain extent done that before and knows the deal with it.
All right, so we're going to stop drilling you on the Mets because I imagine 162 games of Mets business is plenty for any beat reporter. But more generally, I mean, we're two young journalism students. We work for our college radio. We worked for our college newspaper. As a beat reporter, what is it like looking for stories, but really just little nuances that cross that threshold of something you want to report on, something you want to look further into? Being so close to the team, how do you take yourself out and see the team from an outward perspective and think, oh, this is something that people will find interesting, or this is a lead that I want to follow?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because I think it's very easy to get lost in the day-to-day, and you know, there's so much going on in terms of little injury updates and what goes on in the games and so on and so forth, that sometimes you can't really see the forest for the trees. You can't really take a step back and look at the bigger picture and what might be of interest to fans. I think, well, for starters, social media is a great forum for that. It's a great place to get a sense of what people who are not involved or are not around the team every day but are invested in the team emotionally, what are they thinking about? What do they care about? I think a great place to start. But more than that, the access that this job provides is just tremendous. I think, you know, you talk about sports writing. Baseball is the king, and it always was the king because, you know, baseball is quote-unquote America's pastime, and I think the game lends itself to a lot of drama. But baseball writers over the years, over the decades, have fought really, really hard for really good access. And of the four major sports, we have by far the best. So starting in spring training, we get to spend quality time with these guys every single day. And if you're making good use of that time, you can get to know them. You can get to know what's going on in their lives away from the field, as opposed to just on the field, just what we see on the backs of their baseball cards. So doing that, building those relationships, talking to people, that's how you really find interesting things that are going on with the team. And I think if you're doing the job well, you're able to uncover a lot of those things. It's an interesting mix of people on any team. It's an interesting group of different backgrounds, different nationalities, different desires, different ages, different places in their careers. And there's a lot of interesting things that do go on over the course of a year. So it's a matter of all of that. And like so many things in life, it's a matter of showing up and really kind of immersing yourself in it. But also, like you said, keeping that perspective where you can keep one eye on the bigger picture.
I'm curious how the nature of your job changes in terms of in-season versus off-season, because I imagine in-season, you know, it's certainly not like a day job where you can go home after 5 o'clock and leave everything at work, right? I mean, it seems at least that it's the kind of thing where you're always on the clock, whether it's on Twitter or trying to pump out the game story or whatever it is. And so when the off season does roll around, how does it change the kind of work that you do? Does it more end up being like talking to agents or talking to people who are maybe not directly to the players, but people who surround them or surround the team? How does that change?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. It's much less dealing with the players. During the season, you deal with the players every single day. You deal with the manager every single day, and most of the reporting is just that. In the offseason, it flips. It's the front office. What is the team doing from a personnel perspective? Obviously, that involves agents. Like you said, a lot of that comes from relationships that you can build at the industry meetings, the GM meetings, the winter meetings that take place on site at hotels during the winter. So it does change, you know, from a personal perspective. It's good and it's bad. You know, you get to have a little bit more of a real person life. You can go out with friends. You can see family at the end of the night. You're working on a little bit more of a normal schedule because things tend to happen during the business day. But that doesn't mean they don't happen at 3 a.m. sometimes. They certainly do. I like to joke that sometimes it's obviously with a lot less gravity to the situation, but it's almost like being an on-call surgeon. You know, you're always have to be ready to snap to attention when something happens, and you never quite know when it is going to happen. So it's a lot of that. You know, the thing that I really like about it is that there are seasons to it. And by the end of the regular season, you're usually about ready to be off the road and be home for a little while and to enjoy that sort of lifestyle. And then, you know, by the end of the off season, you've been working from home and sitting on your couch and, you know, making so many phone calls until your eyes bleed that you're about ready to go down to Florida and go to spring training and have actual in-person interactions with human beings again. So it's a nice mix. And it's a very, very different job, I would say, in the way we attack it from the off season to the regular season.
You know, I am kind of curious because I know both Bobby and myself are very statistically minded in the way that we look at the game and the way we, you know, evaluate players or talk about it on this podcast. And I'm, you know, sure that's something that you think about as well. I know a lot of beat writers, and especially with websites like FanGraphs and Baseball Prospectus and this and this really wealth of information and statistics that we have at our fingertips. And I'm curious if there are any, not to bring it back to the Mets, but like, are there any players or coaches or front office people who you see as being kind of more tapped into that sort of thing? Because, you know, I think some guys like to go out there and they're like, you know, I just hit the ball, right? And if my coach tells me to do XYZ, I'll do XYZ. And then you have other guys like Max Scherzer, I think, or Joey Votto, who are willing to sit down with you and talk about exit velocity or something like that. So are there guys who stand out to you who maybe take in a little bit more of the advanced statistics sort of thing?
yeah, I think more and more you see it across the game as guys who kind of grew up on this thing and grew up as fans reading this sort of thing become big leaguers and become part of this. And I think more and more you see guys who not even necessarily embrace it the way a fan would, but are aware of it and are aware of what it means more and more and are aware of what they can do. I'll give you a great example. I remember doing a story in spring training on Paul Sewald, one of the Mets relievers, and you know, he was struggling in the minors a little bit and couldn't figure out why. And one member of the Mets front office, who is very sabermetrically inclined, kind of gave him a hint that, well, you look at the results in your pitches and your slider is by far your best pitch, but you throw your fastball the most. And he said, huh, that's interesting. And he started throwing his slider more and started getting a lot more success. And I think you see little anecdotes like that more and more throughout the game where guys are open-minded and willing to change what they do based on what statistics that we didn't have in the past tell us. I think you see, you know, another pitcher, Jerry Blevins, is a great example of a guy who's well aware of all the things that, you know, you might see on a stat sheet that players even 10 years ago would have scoffed at. I think you will see it more and more. Daniel Murphy in the flyball revolution, you know, it's a great example. I think Kevin Long, the hitting coach, is one of the major proponents in baseball of guys increasing their launch angle and showing that that helps you hit more home runs and more home runs to the full side and doing those things. And Daniel Murphy is kind of like the godfather of all of that. Justin Turner is part of it. And more you see it throughout baseball. And it's one of the major factors that contributed to all the home runs this year. So I think 10 years from now, it's going to be even more ingrained in the culture. I think teams have to be not only be aware of it, but embrace it. Every team in baseball has a large number of data analysts in this day and age. Every baseball writer, not necessarily is, but should be versed in this sort of thing. And like I said, as the year goes by, it's just going to be more and more.
Well, maybe we'll have to get a Sewald and Blevins on here next.
Yeah, hopefully. All right, Anthony, we don't want to steal any more of your time, but we really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us today. I do have to wonder, though, as a beat writer, if there was one team throughout all of history that you could choose to be the beat reporter for just because of the wealth of stories that are there, who would that team be and why?
Oh, yeah, it would be the aforementioned 1986 Mets. I don't think there's any. And I'm not sure I would survive that experience. Just some of the stories that you hear, it's almost like you can't even believe that some of these things are true. But this was not only a baseball team, but a very, very good one. Probably was one of the best in history. So to be even just a fly on the wall in that clubhouse, let alone a reporter, would be an interesting experience.
Yeah, it has spawned, I imagine, many a good book, including The Bad Guys One by Jeff Perlman, which I just finished reading. But yeah, God only knows what other stuff you could have uncovered back then.
God only knows. I think there's some safety hazards of just being on the job.
Thank God there was no Twitter back then. All right, Anthony, thanks again. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for taking the time.
You got it, guys. Loves your mama, loves Jesus, in America too. She's a good girl.
She's crazy about Elvis, loves horses. All right, that'll do it for our show. Thanks again to Anthony DiComo for being our first illustrious guest on the podcast.
Yeah, big thanks to him. That's you know, I don't know if he knows it, but it's a pretty special honor.
Yeah, he's bigger than Tim Tebow would have been for sure.
Oh, totally. I mean, this is a huge get, honestly. No, we really had a really good time talking to him and learned some really cool stuff that I think we were talking last week that we never really know what goes on in the clubhouse, so it's all speculation. So it's good to actually get someone who's been on the inside a little bit.
Yeah, that was really fun.
Yeah, so thanks again to him.
More guests now.
Yeah, yeah. Who's next? If you guys have suggestions, send them our way. Again, that tipping pitches inbox is filled to the brim right now with notifications from Twitter mostly, and it's mostly just us retweeting the tipping pitches account. But you know, send us some suggestions. Tippingpitchespod@gmail.com.
Yeah, Anyway, appreciate y'all listening, and enjoy playoff baseball.
Yeah, the next time we see you, some things will have shaken out. We'll have a very clear view of what these playoffs are going to look like. So, yeah, we will see you then.
All right, bye, y'all. We're home with broken hearts. Now I'm free.